Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Leslie Gelb, who's the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and former columnist for The New York Times. He also served as Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs in the Carter administration. His books include Our Own Worst Enemy, The Unmaking of American Foreign Policy, and Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. He has an article in Sunday's New York Times, co-authored with Dimitri Symes, A New Anti-American Axis. Just to touch on the call we just did with Cairo, one of the organizers of the original revolution was saying that the Mubarak era police have come back. They think this revolution is their chance to, in effect, capture the counter-revolution and go after both the Islamists and the people that they're very bitter against, which are the revolutionaries who brought about the original revolution. I take it there's not a lot the United States can do.
Are you asking me?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Look, the first thing to understand about a situation like this is that we exaggerate what we know is going on. We don't have a good feel for it. It's a culture that we know very little about. Our contact is mainly with people at the top, not with people in the streets, let alone the security forces or even the army people who are in there now. Most of the army people we knew well, were removed from power by Morsi over the last year or so. So we're guessing. What we do know is that this is a riotous, tumultuous situation where almost anything can happen, and it's likely to be quite ugly for some time.
So let's turn then to your article co-authored with Dimitri Symes in Sunday's New York Times, A New Anti-American Axis, that argues Russia and China now see less cost in challenging the United States and fewer rewards for acting as a partner. I take it you weren't convinced by Putin's recent remarks about Edward Snowden, saying we don't want him to damage relations with our American partner, even though it may seem odd coming from my lips.
I think he doesn't want relations with the United States to fall off the cliff. Neither does China. But there's no question over the last year plus, both of them have been making our lives miserable in a number of places, challenging us, pushing us back, and demonstrating that they can stand up to us and that they can refuse to do what we ask of them. But they don't want to destroy relations with us. They have some important common interests, especially economic common interests.
Well, I imagine pushing back against the only superpower, the United States, plays well in Russia amongst the so-called Narod. Whatever happens in China, of course, is completely controlled by the party, although my understanding is that more and more Chinese are joining the internet and getting news that's real news and don't believe a lot of what their government is telling them. But throughout the world, even amongst our allies, there's a considerable amount of anti-Americanism. So isn't, how much is the anti-American card being played here?
I think a lot more than it has been played in over the last 10 plus years. Take a look at Syria, where particularly Russia, but also China, particularly Russia has been doing everything it can to sort of thwart our side of this battle, namely the rebels, and to do everything it can within reason to support the regime of President Assad. And if you go across to the other side of the earth, you'll see that China has been making claims about its sovereignty in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea, and sending naval ships. And just in case anybody has missed what they're up to, they're in the process, both those nations now, of conducting a major joint naval exercise in Far Eastern waters. So you know, they're sending us a message, and they're sending a message to other countries around the world that they have to be taken into account.
Well, in terms of Syria, though, the Russians at least have some fairly sound arguments. Obviously, they've always supported the Alawites, the Assad clan, but they are concerned over, as you point out in your article, Leslie Gelb, they are concerned about serious Christians, especially the Orthodox Christians, their co-religionists. They're also concerned about the Al-Qaeda-type Sunni activists, terrorists, as we call them, that have come in. You know, the Saudis are playing their old game of emptying the jails and saying, you know, if you either protest against us or go off and fight jihad in Syria. And as far as the Russians are concerned, that's only 500 miles away from Chechnya, and they're the same kind of people that they're fighting in Chechnya. So they think the U.S. is being incredibly stupid.
Yeah, and so, as do the Chinese. The Chinese face a Uyghur threat, a Muslim threat in the western part of China, and they fear radical Islam there too. And they think that the United States is promoting this sort of thing, or at least not looking carefully into how all of this will affect Russia and China. And they think Syria is a touchstone right now, and they don't want to see radical Islam win. They didn't like what happened in Libya. They both sort of stepped aside there and didn't make a big issue of it. And now they're sorry about failure to prevent us from taking action there.
Well, though, if for example, the U.S. hadn't taken action when Gaddafi was threatening to wipe out the opposition in Benghazi, my assumption would have been what would have happened is that he would have been an international pariah, and that the U.S. and Europe couldn't have done business with Gaddafi anymore, and therefore the people that would have done business in Gaddafi's oil fields would have been the Chinese and the Russians. Wasn't that a factor in the U.S. and European decision?
I don't think it was a major factor at all. I think it was mainly the chance to, quote, overthrow a dictator and bring the semblance of democracy to Libyan shores. I think it was the West acting, in my mind, very, very foolishly, and once again failing to understand the basis of their own democracies. You know, we tend to equate democracies with getting rid of bad guys. And sure, I want to get rid of the bad guys. And we tend to equate democracies with holding elections. And sure, democracies involve elections. But you can't have a real democracy unless you have the democratic institutions, the democratic cultures. And that takes a while to build up. Otherwise, the elections are a sham. We should have learned that already with Gaza. George W. Bush wanted to hold elections in Gaza. Let's bring democracy to Gaza. Well, they held elections there. Hamas won, and that was the end of democracy in Gaza. You know, we have this fetish about elections being the heart of democracy. The elections are really the capstone of democracy. And we used to understand this. We did help to bring democracy to dictatorships such as South Korea, Taiwan, and Turkey. But over the years, we began to push those countries to develop freer press, rule of law, business law, allow non-governmental organizations to function, so that after 20 or 30 years, when they held truer elections, they could begin to function as real democracies. But it took all that time to do so.
Well, I think that's in many ways what's happening in Egypt, isn't it? I mean, our revolution took a while. None of these things happen in one fell swoop. But so where do you start?
I think you start by pushing the leadership to develop these democratic institutions and a democratic culture. You don't start with the elections. You know, you had to know almost nothing about Egypt to fail to understand that the Muslim Brotherhood was going to win those elections because they were the only organized political group in that country. They were the only ones who could turn out the vote. So, of course, they were going to win, just like Hamas was the only ones who could turn out the vote in Gaza. You hold the elections, the results were inevitable, except to our leadership.
Well, in this case, of course, Condoleezza Rice was blindsided by the Hamas elections. And what happened there was that the PLO, being an incredibly corrupt organization, that the people in Gaza had a choice between Hamas, which was like the Salvation Army that delivered services, and the PLO, or the Palestinian Authority, which were like the mafia. And they ran about 10 candidates per canton, whereas the other Hamas people were much more organized and ran one candidate. And
well,
guess who won?
You didn't have to be a genius about the Gaza Strip to know that was going to happen.
Well, why weren't our people paying attention?
You know, because we're fixated on these damn elections, as if that's the cure-all, the simple solution. But it isn't, time and again.
Again, I'm speaking with Leslie Gelb, who's the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and former columnist for The New York Times. He also served as Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs in the Carter administration, and his books include Our Own Worst Enemy, The Unmaking of American Foreign Policy, and Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. He has an article in Sunday's New York Times, co-authored with Dimitri Symes, A New Anti-American Axis. And back to the Snowden affair, where your piece begins talking about how both Russia and China have been less than cooperative, and a lot of people assume that all of the computers and thumb drives that Edward Snowden is carrying with him have already been compromised. The Chinese intelligence people, if they weren't doing their job, it's hard to believe they weren't doing their job in Hong Kong. And likewise, I talked to the former KGB general who ran all the American spies in Washington, General Oleg Kalugin, the other day, about that area in the Moscow airport. And I said, surely the KGB or the successor agency, the SVR, control that area? And because of course they do. And you know, if they don't have those secrets, then they're not doing their job. So, but it does seem that Snowden, in many ways, is being run by Julian Assange, who even his host, the president of Ecuador, seems to be peeved with him. Getting out ahead of the president's and by characterizing a conversation that Correa had with Vice President Joe Biden in a way that caused Correa to have to rebuke his guest in his embassy. So how much do you think this whole situation is being run by Assange and the great global powers like the United States, China, and Russia are just being whipsawed?
Well, I don't think that China and Russia were being whipsawed. Snowden could not have gotten out of Hong Kong without the okay of the Chinese government, plain and simple. I don't think anyone disputes that. And no one disputes that he will be unable to leave Sheremetyevo Airport today without the approval of the Russian government. Now, where he will go, if they let him go, and I think they will, it has a lot to do with Assange, which countries will give him sanctuary. But whether or not he can go was up to China in the first instance, and now was up to Russia in the present one.
But how much, Leslie Gelb, do you think the Chinese are concerned about their own Edward Snowdens and, to a lesser extent, the Russians about their Edward Snowdens?
I think they are concerned, and I would hope that we've made contact with some version of Edgar Snowden in those countries, and that we've siphoned off some of their secrets, because they sure as hell have a lot of ours right now.
So do you think that whatever's going on, you're suggesting that Obama has softened his rhetoric internationally or publicly, because in Africa he sort of tried to dismiss Snowden as being an overblown story.
That really was absurd. He called Snowden a hacker. Right. And the reason why he called him a hacker is he finally cottoned on to the fact that the Russians were tweaking his nose, making him look weak. So somebody told him to back off, but I think he used the wrong word in backing off to simply dismiss Snowden as a hacker, because that undermines what his own government is trying to achieve, what I think they should try to achieve, bringing him back here as a major violator of U.S. Espionage Act.
But doesn't Obama
call him a hacker?
Sure.
Call him a hacker undercuts that.
Well, my sense, though, is that Obama has a problem in as much as he's already unpopular with the left of the Democratic Party, and many liberals and progressives in this country see Snowden as a hero. On the other hand, the intelligence community apparently are doing a damage assessment that could be catastrophic. And at the end of the day, when they figure out how much they've lost, there may well be a right-wing backlash in this country demanding a stronger Patriot Act. In other words, the opposite of what Snowden was trying to get, because the next step would be contagious liability with the press. In other words, laws that would mean that if a Snowden hands a Glenn Greenwald or a Guardian newspaper secrets, they are liable.
Now, you know, I can understand, I don't agree with, but I can understand why the Democratic left is sympathetic to Snowden when he revealed surveillance of American citizens. They say, hey, that's counter to democracy here. But when he started to divulge secrets that involve how we collect information on our adversaries, he went way beyond doing anything to protect American democracy. And I don't see how Democrats or Republicans Libertarians or whoever can justify that part of Snowden's actions at all.
So who do you think was behind the timing of the first leak, which happened on the eve of the meeting with the new Chinese leader Xi and Obama in Palm Springs? On the eve of that, the release of a presidential finding signed by Obama targeting China and other countries for cyber warfare came out. That surely undercut Obama's negotiating with the Chinese.
Because it made public what everybody knew what we were trying to do and doing, and what the Chinese are trying to do and doing.
I understand, but
who
made that decision to leak it? Did the Chinese have Snowden in their pocket by then?
I don't know. I assume Snowden was smart enough to do some bargaining. So I don't know what he had given up or withheld at that point in time. But I would have to bet that in order to get out of Hong Kong, he forked over some valuable information to the Chinese.
And the other leak that took place on the eve of the G8 conference embarrassed the hosts that the G20 conference was bugged. And was that... Did that serve Putin, who, of course, was the odd man out in that conference?
Sure it did. Sure it did, because it embarrassed us. And, you know, in the eyes of some Europeans, equated America with Russia. That just as Russia was trying to subvert European democracy, we were too. Now, there's no doubt he took a happy chuckle in that one.
So is it possible that by that time, of course, Snowden was effectively in Russian custody?
Sure. He was and he is. And he's not going to get out of there until the Russians are satisfied they've got what they need from him. These are very tough guys, and international relations is a tough business. Americans don't like to talk about it much. They don't like to do it, except if you're in power and you realize that doing it is part of protecting our country.
Well, Leslie Gelb, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Leslie Gelb, who's the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and former columnist for The New York Times. He also served as Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs in the Carter administration, and his books include Our Own Worst Enemy, The Unmaking of American Foreign Policy, and Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. He has an article in Sunday's New York Times, co-authored with Dimitri Symes, A New Anti-American Axis. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the brazen Senate bill that's put forth by a bipartisan group of senators that would render impotent the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and the National Labor Relations Board.